Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So there's a treasure trove of questions here, which is very helpful. Because as always, I was thinking, what the heck am I going to talk about? I've been talking about Dharma for so many years, and I think, well, you know, what's to say? Just let go. That's it. So really. But I was experiencing some Garfield. I was experiencing throat envy. Garfield's got this fabulous deep voice. Ooh, I love that. But I won't be reborn for that.
You have a deep voice.
Yeah. My father was, he sang in a men's choir. And they were refugees from Latvia, so they ended up in Germany. My brother was born in the war, I was born after the war. So it's kind of a refugee situation. And what the Americans did is they concentrated the different nationalities in different towns. So there were several enclaves of Latvians, and they, whatever buildings were left, they housed the refugee families in the families of German people who were still alive, were still living. So my family ended up sharing a flat with a German family, which would have been interesting. Anyway, my dad, he and his mates started up a choir, and they toured the kind of war zone and did concerts and raised money. Really, really clever. My dad was a survivor. He was a lawyer in Latvia, and he lost it all, and then he studied electronics in Toronto and worked for Motorola. Motorola moved to the States, he lost all that. Then he studied accounting. Real, real hard working survivor. Good voice, too. And then he used to play choral music, and he was also, he was an electronics buff, so he created this fabulous sort of hi-fi system. And he used to play choral music and opera at like really loud decibels. So it wasn't the teenagers that were doing it, Dad was doing it. So finally he was banned, and he had to get a fair, and he got himself earphones so we could be peaceful. So we had lots of classical music around the house. Anyway, this has got nothing to do with anything. But I'll take a chance to use these questions because it's very helpful. Is there a difference in practice between being aware that you are aware and choiceless awareness, which I have taken to mean being awake and open to whatever comes up in consciousness, for example, sounds, passing thoughts, and body sensations? If there is a difference, please try to explain. For me, there is a subtle difference, but I think they all, these kinds of nebulous practices do lead to emptiness where the sense of self falls away. So, like, just turning attention to attention is very, very interesting, because the whole sense of, for me, when I do that, the whole sense of a person practicing falls away. And there's still consciousness, but it's empty of any, it's empty of the doer. And the choiceless awareness will do that too, but sometimes they're, I guess it's a kind of, for me, an intensification of the same idea. Because what I think both of them are pointing to is this, that strong sense of me doing something to become something, which I perceive, and challenging that sense of the doer. And you find that in meditation, the sense of a person doing something falls away as the meditation becomes more subtle, and there's consciousness, but there isn't a doer. And that's quite surprising. frightening for some people. And then to abide as that is what I would see as the practice of abiding in emptiness and equanimity. So with these things, they're just, you know, they're just suggestions. Just try them out and see if they're effective, how they might work. Danger, I give lots of suggestions and you kind of pitter-patter from one to the other and you don't really pick up one and go deeply. So that's the kind of downside of it. The upside is you have options. but obviously, we are all of different temperaments, so if I just said one thing all the time, it might be effective. Say the way Mr. Goenka runs his retreats, it's quite effective. You know, it's kind of like McDonald's, you know, it's just kind of set out for you what you do, and that has a very, very powerful effect, apparently. I've done that. But I just try to offer some suggestions, but that mind, looking at the mind, is quite a classical. You see that in Sino-Buddhism, you see that in Advaita Vedanta, you see that in Ramana Maharshi. So the who am I is like that. The Wato in Chinese, what Ramana Maharshi says, the I am, go to the I am. But if you try to find that as a... try to define I in a conceptual way, you just go crazy. I am Viradhamma, I am a man, I am an old man, I am a young man, I am not old, I am not young. And there's just thought. So to go to the very sense of personhood requires silence. And it takes you to silence. So it's like the Ramana Maharshi youth that who am I? But if the whole trick of it is not to try to find an answer, just to bring the question, who am I? And then let go of trying to find an answer and the mind is silent. Use that a lot. In the Chinese Buddhism, they use that too. So that's all around that same idea. The origin of dukkha is craving. What is the origin of craving? Ignorance. I got it, didn't I? I play an instrument in a band. I am not satisfied with my playing, so I take lessons and practice. Is this becoming? Does this have anything to do with right effort? No, I think it's quite skillful. It's very much how training the mind works. It's a good analogy for training the mind. Where the becoming would be if it was egotistical, you know, if it was competitive or, you know, you kind of the feeling, oh, I'm not getting anywhere in my practice, I'll never be a constant musician, and all that self-thinking would be involved with becoming. But just to take a craft and learn for the sake of learning, I think is a very skillful use of mind-body. And music does, I've never played a musical instrument. I remember in high school, I wanted to play a musical instrument, they made me study Latin. So I had to become a monk. But I find, like, if I pick up a craft, you know, I like to work with my hands and just pick up a new craft, I just find the process of learning interesting. How does one learn? How do you go from not knowing how to do something and then you pick it up and you do it and you fumble and someone tells you and you read something and then someone tells you and you fumble and then lo and behold, all of a sudden you're doing it. That's really quite magical, isn't it? And it's the same with cultivating meditation. So I think the lessons one learns in any craft which should be applicable to developing meditation. And then also just consider the qualities to truly develop a craft. You need to be persistent. You can't just sort of pick it up and then put it down. If you're going, you have to be persistent. You have to do a lot of boring exercises, perhaps. You have to build up a certain stamina. Many things, right? It's very much that in meditation. You have to meditate with boring states of mind and seeming failures in your meditation, it doesn't seem to be getting anywhere, you just persist. So you're developing paramitas again, the character of determination, persistence, application of mind, watching cause and effect, seeing how certain activities lead to good results, certain activities don't lead to good results. Same adjusting your, you know, if you're playing a flute or something, you adjusting your finger. Don't know how to play the flute, but seems to me it's actually very much in line. The becoming part would be the egotistical part, where you become arrogant in your playing, or self-disparaging in your playing, or just obsessed in getting it right, you know, all the different ways one could think of that. But if it was just an exercise in the joy of craft, because that can be very, very rewarding on a level which is not just about greed. It's about using mind and body in an expressive way, in a creative way. The suffering would also might come that if that facility was one that really absorbed you and calmed you. Let's say you're a guitar player and you lost a hand. Grim image. You know, you put your hand in the chainsaw or whatever and you lost your hand. See how attached you were to it, not to your hand, but also to the music playing. What a horrible image. But that's probably more the image of what happens when your faculties go. Like if there is something you do well, drive a car, whatever it might be, and then you don't have the capacity to do that, and then you're frustrated, then you practice with, then you'd see, can I now adapt to that? A situation of limits. Because the aging process is very much one of limits, isn't it? It's kind of constantly until you're just in a chair. You could see that with old people that I've been with, the world just becomes a chair with more tables around it. You know, they have everything around, don't they? They have their books and their glasses and their cups and you know, it's like this little empire, and that's their world. And so limitations are always that way, kind of challenge you. But then when you do have a chance to express yourself, when you do have a chance to use the body, great, yeah, why not? Whether it's athletics or jogging or whatever, these are, I think it's important to find ways of expression, because what we're doing is very passive. It's active in the sense we're applying our minds, but there's a whole part of our life which is engaging with our sense of design or our sense of movement or and so many other things, and that's important too. And so like monastic life, I think monks who have a hard time is ones who don't really find a way of expression. Somehow they don't find a niche in teaching or in study or in meditation, and they've kind of their hearts sort of die out and they have to leave. So expression is obviously it's very important, and that's I think the danger of Buddhism also. It just sounds like you can't do anything. I know this sort of horrible teaching where, you know, you get enlightened and you die, never come back. It's the ending of these things. They're really grim, aren't they? But Ajahn Amaro had, when he met Ajahn Chah, he said here was this little man. Ajahn Chah was like 5'2", had no money, was celibate, had no music. Slept on a wooden bed without a mattress, ate one meal a day, had no car, and had a lot of responsibility, and was the happiest man he ever met. He thought, oh, that's different than what I thought happiness was. So it's just the end of that sutta. It's like, whoa, this is grim. But it's like, but there's also, you know, the way that liberation is talked about, there's the island, there's peace, and when you, you know, when you see beings who have really worked at this, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Ajahn Smith, or Pacha, they really have something there which is a jewel, which is very, very valuable. But I know Ajahn Smith now, like he'll be in Kushinara in about a month. Kushinara is the holy site where we think the Buddha passed away. And Lompo Smedo is 80 years old, and he's really interested in death. And he's not interested in rebirth. You know, he says, I don't want to recycle. I'm not, you know, and but death for him isn't like annihilation. That's the thing. It's a realization of the unborn and the undying. So that's different than annihilation would mean that my consciousness is just, that's it, black hole, finish, kaput. But the teaching is not that. It's not an annihilating teaching. It's just something that is ineffable in terms of language. What liberation really is, that's where language is limited, because language is constructed, it's structured, it's conditioned. So I know my faith certainly has been strengthened by my own experiences, but also my teachers showing me there is this profound possibility in human hearts, and it is vibrant with love, and it's vibrant with silence. But as soon as you put a positive on it, the desire mind seeks that positive attribute, and you're finished. And you're looking for an attribute, and that's the very skill of letting go, is that the attributes come as a byproduct. So it's this kind of gentle art of letting go. And yet we can cultivate attributes, we can cultivate metta bhavana and use methodologies to still the mind, and so on. So play on. Okay, moving along. I like the ignorance one best. Oh, here's another good one. Can you offer any teaching on the Dharmakaya? No. I don't know. That's Mahayana. I've never studied that. Yes, I like those. I mean, I've seen the word, but I've not studied it, so I don't know. Sorry. Could equanimity be compared to apathy or indifference? How can we develop spaciousness around experiences? Yeah, that I can do. So, upekā is the Pali word, and we chanted that in the book on the four divine abidings. And the way I perceive that teaching, that it's a part of a fourfold teaching, equanimity. It's not in isolation. And then that fourfold teaching is goodwill, is one of the attributes of the open heart. Compassion is one of the attributes of the open heart. Gladness and equanimity. So all four, to me, seem to be a part of it. If you just had the one without the others, I don't think you'd have the Buddha's take on equanimity, because those, you find that structure throughout the text. You do also find equanimity is a very, has different levels that it's talked about in the books. But in this case, I see it as a kind of empathy, equanimity. So goodwill, metta, is the empathy that we're all in this together. And just as you suffer, I suffer. Just as I want to be free from pain, you want to be free from pain. Just as you enjoy happiness, I enjoy happiness. That's the sense of goodwill or commonality that we have with all beings. And that's, you know, metta is defined, you know, we chant it as loving kindness, but that sometimes seems too big. But just the sense of goodwill, that I can do, as opposed to ill will. And that comes from that empathy, that just as you you suffer when you have the flu, I suffer when I have the flu. And may you be free from the flu, rather than, you know, may you get Ebola. which is cruelty, ill will. So that's a part of the open heart. And there is this aspect of empathy in our consciousness when we're not self-consumed. When we're self-consumed, we don't notice. We don't have, or we're just so selfish. We wish ill will on people we don't like and wish goodwill on others. And then compassion is that real sense of, oh, you're suffering, aren't you? Wow, how can I help you? Oh, that must be really difficult, you know, how can I I'm going to just listen to you and help you along, that compassion that we have. And that's also part of empathy. Empathy which responds not from egotism, but from the situation. And then gladness is another kind of empathy. When empathy to beauty, I like to think of it as to beauty, or someone, you know, does something which is really makes something, or has an attribute of character which I really admire and think, wow, that's wonderful. Then there's a sense of gladness. So I think whenever any of us have met the Dalai Lama, he really makes you glad, doesn't he? I've met him several times, and you think, just wow, this man makes me happy. Ajahn Chah was like that too. I get a lot of gladness being with Ajahn Sumedho from just being in their presence. A child who has a, you know, some kind of says something really endearing. You have this kind of gladness which comes up. So that's called mudita. We have metta, karuna, mudita, and then upekā. I think is an empathy with the Dharma. You know that. As beings, we are heirs to our karma. We're born of our karma, related to our karma. Whatever we shall do, for good or for ill, of that we shall be the heir. For everyone. So the idea that there are karmic results, we are inheritors of those things. That being born into this world is not easy, and that the body suffers pain and suffers sickness, and we die. It's a natural part of it, as well as the beauty, the gladness, and such like. So equanimity, if it became apathy, would lack what? It would lack karuna. It would lack compassion. It would lack gladness. It would lack goodwill. So indifference and apathy would not be empathy. There would be a closing down of the heart system, wouldn't they? And certainly, one could read it that way, but that would not be a kind of Buddhist perspective on that. So upekā is quite difficult. I mean, again, it's listed in the books and also in terms of meditative absorption, so there are levels of that kind of consideration. But just your kind of more common garden variety, it's quite difficult for a mother to have upekā around her child's suffering. It's quite easy probably for a normal mother to feel goodwill towards a child, to feel compassion to the child's difficulties, to feel gladness at the child's successes, but to feel upekā for the child's problems at school or misunderstandings or all the stuff that we get up to as kids and adults and such like, that's hard to accept that. And yet, I guess every parent knows at some level, yeah, they have to learn. They have their challenges, they have their difficulties. But to have equanimity there would not mean that you're indifferent to the child's suffering. No, you still the compassion would be there, but then you have problems of boundaries. You know, how do you, you know, the child wants to grow and wants to make their own mistakes. And you go, okay, hit a wall again, okay. And then you try to maybe, I don't know, I don't have kids, but try to give the child advice, and no, I'm going to do it myself. You sure? And they learn, somehow they learn. But, so upekā is, it's the way, so the second part of the question, how do you develop spaciousness around experience? Well, I think what you work with is you work with where you don't have equanimity. That's the only way you can develop equanimity. When you have equanimity, I mean, you don't notice it. Right, someone presses your buttons and you notice it. Oh, okay, I get reactive there. But when you have no buttons, you just think it's normal not to react. When you see someone else reacting, it's, what's their problem? Why they're reacting? And you don't realize in those issues you have equanimity. It's not an issue for you. So when your buttons get pressed, then that's, you know, you have to deal with the particulars of that experience, the reactivity, is that, but there's also just the general pattern of the mind which reacts. So you have to kind of program your mind, don't you? You have to say to yourself, yeah, whenever I get that kind of criticism, I get very defensive. Or whenever a person says that, you know, talks to me in that particular, that person talks in that particular way, I get very aggressive or reactive, and I have to just somehow make conscious or make intentions to notice, say, my defensiveness. So someone says to me something about Theravada Buddhism, that it's, you know, it's really Mickey Mouse Buddhism, the real thing is Tibetan Buddhism. I say, no, it's not. It's the oldest school. Mahayanists. They don't really. You know, so I notice that, and I get defensive, and I'm honest. I see, well, that's not upekkha for sure, mate. And then rather than blaming, I just watch that kind of defensiveness in me. And the more I can make the intentions, I can see where I lose spaciousness, and I get narrow-minded and whatever. And so, okay, that's what I want to work with. That's where I want to work, to be mindful of my reactivity until that reactivity fades away. And then I have upekkha. So you develop patience in those situations that make you impatient, obviously. You don't have to develop patience where you have patience. So the very thing that inflicts itself upon you, obviously, is the thing that you learn from. And that's a kind of cliche, but it's true, isn't it? But some things you don't learn from, you get overwhelmed by them, you have a nervous breakdown. So I don't advocate just kind of going into the fire and say, oh, great, I'm being toasted. I'm not an absolutist that way, because the old adage is one more learning experience and I'll be dead. One more growth experience and I'll be dead. So I've certainly seen that with situations where my buttons get pressed so much that I just get exhausted. They have to take me on a stretcher. So it's not, all things aren't necessarily edifying, but there's a lot where we do react, and we take that on board. That's the practice, okay? And then I think that the challenge is to get enough mind, get your foot in the doorway there, and get enough mindfulness to say, well, okay, where's it in the body? I'm really reacting, and somehow just pausing with speech and not just blurting something out or going to the fridge and you know, annihilating a tub of ice cream or something like that. But actually just like being with the rawness of the reactivity and waiting it out. That's a big step oftentimes in our reactivity. And once you kind of can do it a few times, then the next time it becomes easier and easier and easier. And then the heart has a upekkha, equanimity. Certainly like monastic life is I suppose, very much like family life, where we are, we're just a group of men living together, and we're all different characters, strong opinions, strong views, and so we certainly have frictions, but fortunately we have pretty good vinaya to contain that. And then just watching those very situations where someone I just feel confused by or annoyed by their behavior, and I know it's actually, it's not against the rules, it's just something that gets up my nose. And then I say, okay, that's the practice right there. Rather than thinking, I'll get blokes in the monastery who agree with me and that would weaken me, I think. Having said that, I don't want people that are gonna crucify me either. So I do some selective ordaining. But I'll never get it all right. So I think the attitude one is one where it's all practice, right? It's all practice, even this person. But yet realizing one's limits, saying there's boundaries, and saying, no, this is too much. That's all valid. But not to kind of just run away from life because it's difficult. That would be a weakening. Right. Detaching from outcomes is skillful. How can we prevent slipping into apathy? Detaching from outcomes is skillful. I think reflecting on outcomes is skillful. If I get too detached from outcomes, I wouldn't see cause and effect. I don't know. If the outcome of my meditation was that I got more agitated, you'd think I wanted, well, that, well, I was doing something wrong there, right? So maybe detaching from the ego part of outcomes, but seeing cause effect is pretty primal to the feedback that we need for understanding ourselves. In a worldly way, detaching from outcomes, yeah, like you can see, like you get a new car and it's a nice BMW or something like that, and someone dings it the first day. You better let go of that car. But I think outcomes are actually very important. What the cause and effect, what happens to the mind when I do this or I do that, when I speak in this way, act in this way, consume this and consume that. How can we prevent slipping into apathy? Well, I think seeing results which are unskillful really rings the alarm bells, doesn't it? When I say something to someone which can, when I come from someplace, say as an example, and I berate them from self-righteousness, but you should do this and you should do that, the outcome is disastrous. I feel terrible remorse, and no one wants to see me, and they might stop feeding me if I'm not careful. So the outcome is, it's disastrous, and they say, well, that's not very good. And that brings up a lot of energy for me. If I say something which a person misapprehends, and they feel put out by me, I say, well, that's your mind. But if I say something, and I know I was coming from a place of unskillfulness, I know that I have to own up to that. If I say something because I'm just tired and I just say, leave me alone, I'm not too worried about that. But if I say something deliberate and it's hurtful to people, then I really feel awful. I don't do it much anymore. And that is a kind of bell-ringing outcome which makes me be careful, don't do that. You know, one of the things that I find this last year of my life, I keep coming up, don't make any more karma. Be careful, don't make any more karma. Don't do things which you're going to just, you're going to torture your mind and create a strong sense of self. My dad died at 74, and so I joke around and say, well, I could probably, I'm 67, I got a few years for good behavior, I probably got 10 left. And it's a very sobering thought. He goes, oh, no, Bhante, you'll live to be 106. I said, oh, no, please, don't say that. So who knows, right, who knows? But it's a kind of a sobering thought, I've got 10 years left, what do I want to do? Well, I know what I don't want to do. I don't want to do anything stupid or make any karma. So like with speech and action and all that, to kind of be really, really careful. So that's not apathetic. I think that idea that detaching from outcomes is skillful, I think there's, be careful of the word detaching. Detachment is not, it doesn't mean non-grasping is really a more fundamental, like this seems like almost sounds like it comes from an ego sense of what detachment is. Non-grasping is is seeing the khandhas as anicca-dukkha anatta. That's its kind of basic from this text, from our morning chanting, the khandhas. It's like the seeing the khandhas as not self. That's what detachment is. But in terms of conventional truth, there is, like as in our Vinaya, we have a responsibility to live by our rules, and if we don't, we get called on it. If a monk is misappropriating the chocolate bars or not fulfilling duties, so we all call each other on it. So there's definitely, and for a monk to say, well, I'm just detached. Oh, yeah? I just didn't come to the morning meeting because I'm not attached to form and ritual. Oh, is it right? Oh, really cool. I think we'd have issues with that one. So there's a kind of joke, isn't there, where the someone says to the teacher something about detachment, and the teacher whacks him in the head, right? Oh, you're feeling pain, are you? Detached, are you? So detachment is a misunderstood word, I think. It's not apathy. It's not doing nothing. It's like doing a lot, right? Like really being diligent in one's social responsibilities, and then doing a lot in seeing where grasping takes place. And seeing how difficult it is to not get caught up with ego thinking and grasping of self. It's very difficult, isn't it? And I think, Susan, that going to the mind, looking at the mind, really touches a sense of emptiness. If you can get the subtlety of that. It's an interesting one. Okay, how are we doing for time? Two questions related to thinking. Is it ever skillful during formal practice to try to resolve, understand a current significant issue arising in one's life? Not really. We've got plenty of time to do that. It's tempting, and sometimes you have to. You know, sometimes it's just like you got to deal with it. But too often, we get very little time for quiet. We get very little time to develop samatha. We give ourselves very little time. Even our culture gives us very little time. So to not spend that time to develop a meditation object and so on, that would be a shame. Right? But, you know, nothing's verboten. You can you can do it, and sometimes it's just so powerful, you do resolve it. But so often, you know, the temptation is, I got this good idea. And I haven't had this idea before. It's a really good idea. And then, you know, then the bell rings. And so be careful of because the meditation object quite often is just very, very neutral, not interesting. So then the mind produces this interesting idea, and that's just tanha, which is seeking the interesting and doesn't want to be with the uninteresting. But to see that movement of mind towards something, that whole movement outwards to thought, and stay with it, brings you to samadhi, brings you to a deeper silence. But having said that, sometimes it can be useful. Suggestions, please, about inquiring during formal practice into entrenched patterns of behavior of lifelong duration without thinking about the past. Well, I try to see entrenched patterns of behavior of lifelong duration in everyday life, and usually they don't come up in meditation. They come up in relationship to people in life and situations. So that's for me the best time to see their arising. I don't have to go into the past. I see them in the present. So my anxieties around giving talks and all of that, they're, you know, entrenched from a lifetime of shyness and self-disparagement. So then when I'm on my own, it didn't really come up much. You know, I'm not shy of the spiders in my kuti. I can give them a talk, no problem. Put me in front of some people. So right then, okay, that's a pattern, that's a habit. With this as condition, that arises. So what we use in the patterning of the mind, we don't use so much personal history, we use dependent origination. This being that comes to be. When there is this, there's that. When there's not this, there's not that. So with... this doesn't happen now, but before, with the audience as condition, there's stage fright. It arises, and it says, see it, oh yeah, that's the pattern, but this is condition that arises. And then just to see, oh yeah, okay, that has arisen. And that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease. Oh, it's changing, it'll change. No, it won't. No, it'll change. And the self, the sense of self is there, isn't it? We'll read something, practice something, do something. No, this is fear. Fear goes this way. It has arisen. No, you just keep practicing. The thoughts keep coming. No, practice. So don't go to the thinking. That's the challenge. Go to the body. Don't go to the thinking. And then you feel in the body, vibrating, and then it's off to thought again. Back to the body. Off to thought again. Back to the body. And that's very much like training a musical instrument, isn't it? Kind of the persistence with this pattern. I'm gonna figure this thing out. I'm gonna win on this one. And that's not ego. It's determination and persistence, isn't it? And in some of these patterns, you got to give it at least 20 years. You do, don't you? They're so strong. They're probably coming from lifetimes before. So if you have I'm just gonna keep. I don't care how often this thing comes up. I'm gonna keep working with it. And that's, I think, body awareness, something where the thinking mind isn't proliferating, because that's where the attachment is. It's through thought, body awareness, and other kinds of perceptions, other kinds of suggestions in thought, which are skillful to balance things out, that kind of thing. So that, but like with fear, for me, I realized. I could suss that one out. That was about 70% of my problems. So I thought, well, if I can suss that, it's 70% freedom there. Yeah, it's true, I'm still a work in progress, but a lot of I don't have much fear anymore, which is just great. And that didn't come through getting rid of it. It's more like enduring it, but not indulging in the patterning, in the habits. And in the beginning, it seemed pretty hopeless. It seemed like this is impossible. This is a mountain which I ain't going to climb. But my teachers kept encouraging me, and I thought, well, what else is there to do? This is the stuff that obsesses my mind, so you better get on with it. And, fortunate I had the kind of opportunity to keep looking at it in this way. So make conscious those patterns. Try to make them conscious, not as a personal problems, but as dharma, as energies, as patterns in nature, and then see what's non-grasping. So what was the non-grasping of fear? It was the bearing witness to fear and saying, even this belongs, even this terror, this panic attack, it belongs, and then which was kindness. It was a kind attitude to a most negative experience, and then not going to the thinking mind. Refusing to go there. And one more. Awareness is the doorway to transcendence. What happens when one steps through? You realize that you were on the other side all at all times. Take that one to bed.
Could you repeat that, please?
You realize that you were on the other side all the time. Don't sleep over it. Pardon my ignorance. When we practice this afternoon meditation on with awareness, is that what Vipassana meditation? I may be caught here in terminology. There's mention about two types of meditation, Samatha and Vipassana meditation. Can you please explain more about the two types of meditation, and do we need to attain Samatha concentration before we reach the Vipassana stage? That's a kind of commentarial way of looking at Buddhism, which is quite common, but the way I was taught is that Vipassana and Samatha are really one thing, that you need focus, you need presence to understand the way things are. As you have more and more presence, you understand the way things are, you have more and more presence. They work hand in glove. So I was never taught that Vipassana is one technique. I was never taught that way. Ajahn Chah always taught them together. But in modern Buddhism, you have many kind of Vipassanas. You have Mr. Goenka's Vipassana. You have Mahasi Sayadaw's Vipassana. Some of that comes from the Abhidhamma. Some of it comes from the Sotimagga. Apparently, it's not a word that's actually that much used in the text, Vipassana itself. So it's become almost a technique that I asked a meditation teacher once. I said, why don't you say you teach Vipassana? Why don't you say Buddhism? And why don't you say Buddhism? She says, well, you need a flavor. You see, you got to say something, right? So I'm always surprised. I'm thinking, well, I do Vipassana. I said, what do you mean you do Vipassana? Do you do formal truths? Do you do? So for me, I've that terminology certainly exists, but I haven't been trained in that kind of delineation. So in terms of samatha, you need enough presence to understand the way things are. So you need to not be falling asleep. You need to be able to hold the mind in presence for long periods of time. And the longer you do that, the deeper the possibility of insight is. But you also need to see cause and effect. You need to see how the mind works. You need to see what produces good samadhi and what is not conducive to good samadhi. And then as these kind of go hand in glove, then there's the deeper insights into egolessness or selflessness or impermanence. So I wouldn't categorize them so clinically. And again, I've never been taught that. Ajahn Chah would say, well, when you pick up a log, you get both ends. That's what he taught me. But that's not just the only way to think of it. So you get different characters teaching. That's what you get. But also you get like a commentarial tradition. So the in the Burmese tradition, Mr. Goenka's methodology and Mr. Mahasi Sayadaw's methodology comes from a very much an Abhidhamma way of looking at things, and so that way of Mahasi Sayadaw become very, very popular in Burma because it was a really good methodology for lay people to do a retreat, because that was kind of nicely packaged and so on. And their methodology came from the Visuddhimagga to a certain extent, which is a commentary. And then Mr. Goenka came from Ubakhin, and Ubakhin apparently taught many methods, but Mr. Goenka picked up the 3 days Anapanasati and the 7 days of, or 6 days of sweeping, and then one day of metta or something like that, kind of very formulaic, which is very good for kind of teaching in a general way. And I guess, is that called Vipassana? Or? Yeah, that's kind of, so that's one kind of Vipassana. So it becomes a kind of way of recognizing one methodology. But I was trained in life. You know, that's I ordained not for a technique, I ordained for a way of living. And there I was always taught like the Four Noble Truths, within which you have sama samadhi, within which you have the recommendation to get to deep levels of samadhi and so on. But you can always reflect. You know, you don't need to have some level of samadhi to reflect. I mean, the deeper the samadhi is, the deeper the reflection is, for sure. But you need to watch cause and effect all the time.